But do you do resolutions?
Not resolutions, but I do intentions, which I feel like are different.
Did you make an intention for this year?
I got 24.
Yeah.
24, what, 20? Well, actually, oh, wow. I've given myself some leeway. I don't have 24. But yeah, usually since 2020, I've done 20 for 2020, 21 for 21, oh, wow. 22 for 22.
That's a lot.
10. Yeah, but it's also like there are things that I don't achieve, like their intentions. They're not necessarily meant to be resolved as a resolution. But like, yeah, so one of mine is to, like, I have given myself a theme.
Yeah.
For the year, which is to fear less.
Fear.
Yeah, to fear less, so to be fearless.
Ah, cool.
Because I'm fucking scared all the time. I'm scared of riding a bike. I'm scared of dogs. I'm scared of the geese near the canal. I'm scared of talking to people I don't know. Like, I'm scared of so many things, and I'm so sick of being scared. So I want to so my intention for the year overall is to fear less. So I'm putting myself out in situations that would normally scare me. So, for example, I tried yesterday to walk past the geese. I did not do that. I was too scared. And I know rationally that they won't do anything because I saw a kid walk by in front of me, not my own son, but somebody else's child.
Just send your kid out.
Yeah, like, go. No, and this kid was totally fine. The geese didn't even turn their heads. But I was like, it's going to be fine. I'm like, no, these geese are going to chase me. Anyway, the point is that, like, I want to stop being scared of things. So I want to feel less. So one of the actual practical things is to have a better system and process. Mm-hmm. So, like.
So this is the way you translate it into your
one of the things.
Work life.
Yeah, one of the things. So, like, ideally, if I hadn't lost my Zoom recorder, I would have, like, everything I need from a Zoom recorder with me. Like extra batteries, whatever.
I'm just checking my battery state. Oh, yeah. It's okay.
But, you know, like, see things that to read instructions. Yeah. Often I'm scared about the unknown, and like sometimes it helps to read instructions and be like, oh, the way to get somewhere is this way.
This is also patience, right? To yeah. Learn. I realize sometimes I'm very impatient in the process of learning, and that's not only in terms of like practical skills, but, you know, just life as learning process kind of thing.
Yeah.
That to also allow for this information to touch you and then to process it, right? Like, yeah, it's the same, like, sit with a booklet, really boring to set up this thing.
I mean, I do find myself to be impatient as well. Like, I do find that sometimes when you're reading as part of your research for an exhibition, sometimes you feel like you should already know this information. And so it feels irritating to actually sit down and spend a day reading. I'd rather like be writing or doing something. It feels too passive.
I feel like this sort of process, I have to remind myself at the end of the day that it feels like I haven't accomplished anything, because maybe I wrote only a paragraph and I spent like the whole day at my desk, and then it like leaves you with this feeling of dissatisfaction. But then I have to remind myself that, oh, but I read and I researched all this other thing, and, you know, like I took notes or anything like that. And I feel like this is kind of a weird production mindset where I have to feel accomplished, where I submitted 5 applications and 50 emails and had 2 Zoom meetings a day. It's like total bullshit.
Yeah, no, I feel that reading is such a big part of my life, my work, but I really have to be in the right mindset. Otherwise, I will be itching. But I also think that's partly to do with the time that we live in, where, like, we have these Instagram reels that are a minute long, and, you know, somebody's dancing dancing to tell you about your menstrual cycle. Like, you need to have all of these different, like, high focus.
Yeah, like very instant inputs.
Yeah.
You know, I used to do resolutions, and I had the fear, the patience, like, over the past year.
Yeah.
Years. Not last year, but I kind of gave up on them because, I don't know. I feel like the end of the year in some way doesn't mean anything. Like, I know that for many people it's like a restart or reset.
Yeah.
I kind of somewhat experienced that sort of like shift once I turned 40. But I didn't feel it at all at the end of the year. I'm just annoyed because the fireworks scare my dog. That's my only relation to like New Year's.
Oh, yeah.
But overall, I feel like it's not a New Year's thing, but like a life thing. I want to focus more on my communities, and I don't want to kind of romanticize that because, you know, communities, we all love each other.
Yeah, not at all.
But I want to invest a little bit more on my human relations.
Oh, yeah, that's good tips.
And that also includes professional relations, but the ones that are maybe genuine and honest and not the ones that are strategic, because those are just sucking out your energy at the end.
I think that is a good life goal. It doesn't have to be for this year, but it is something that you want to perpetuate for the rest of your life. Perhaps the investment in this goal. But I find that I really like knowing people's intentions for the new year. But I also listen to a lot of podcasts about this sort of stuff, and I realized that actually I really like endings and beginnings. And so I was like, actually, I could do this not every, like for the end of the year, but every like end of the quarter, I could like begin afresh. And there's something about that I find really inspiring. And I also like to hear what people want to do for themselves. Like, I find that also really interesting, like what you're saying, like, and also your approach. Like, I also don't think that the intentions that I have, like, I don't have to commit to them completely. I can change them if I want.
Yeah.
One of them is to sing karaoke.
Oh, that's cool.
Well,
be your dream karaoke song.
Well, I've decided this already. It's actually, as I was listening to the song, I'm like, I'd love to sing this in for karaoke. So there's this song called Don't Falter by Mint Royale. I think it came out when I was 16, and I loved it then, and I love it now.
Amazing.
And although I have to say, listening to the lyrics again, it's really like a girl basically like really like giving herself wholeheartedly to a guy, to a point where I'm like, it's a little bit unhealthy. But aside from that, I love the song. And I was like, I could sing this for, at karaoke. And I was like, but I'm just scared of karaoke. I'm like, this is what got to be on my intention for 2024. I was like, just do the fucking thing.
Yeah.
Like, who cares?
Live your life, Elise.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I spent so much, literally today, I spent a good 15 minutes trying to decide whether I'd ride my bike here or not. And I ended up not riding my bike here because I overthought it. I'm like, lady, get yourself together. Like, and I was late because of it. So irritating.
So, you know what you said about like this end of the year and that you like beginnings and endings? I feel like that has something to do maybe with rituals. That's something I've been thinking about, the importance of rituals in like life, that a way of somehow marking time or, you know, like these moments of reflect. And and I don't know how to implement that. I mean, I have some ideas how to implement it, say in like curatorial practice. And we talked about that quite extensively with my friend and colleague, Aneta, with whom I worked recently. But I feel like rituals are very important in life, you know. It's not a coincidence that every religion or any sort of like form of social or cultural organization places such an emphasis on the rituals. And I think New Year's is just like one of these like contemporary ways of doing that. But I think finding maybe your own rituals and then, you know, finding people to participate, like, oh, this is Eloise's ritual day of, I don't know.
Announcing your intentions for the quarter.
Intentions day. I think it's funny, you know, like the same way, like every year we have in my house, like we organize like an egg painting party for Easter. Yeah. I think it's like the most fun day, because children and adults, and it's just like silly things we do, and there's a lot of food. I think that's one of my favorite things, and it's ultimately it's just a ritual, right? But you need this kind of thing, then this is my ritual, so then you can bring your people
I think also what's nice about that is that every year, because it's like adding on to like the history of the egg painting party, it kind of makes it more special because it's like, oh yeah, we've done this for 6 years.
Yes, and we keep the eggs, and I have this egg collection by one of the most outstanding artists of Rotterdam. So
it's so good. No, but I think you're right, and I think that that's also something that like. In some ways, I think there are a lot of artists and that are working around ideas of ritual and all thinking about the artwork as a ritual object, and like, does art provide something that we cannot get from society? Says the, I think the soup's here.
Oh, the soup is here. My dog is barking, but we can just continue. It's
okay. Yeah, yeah. That's life. But yeah, like, I mean, we're also like looking for something, I think, in this Western society. I mean, I can't speak for all, but at least in our community or in our...
Is it art or the process of making and coming together, maybe not in the making process? Okay, now I'm maybe stuck with my... egg painting party, where it is about, you know, making silly eggs and growing my valuable egg collection.
Yeah.
That I'm gonna flip on the art market in a few years. No, but you know, like even art in that sense, like the communities it can bring together, and it might happen in an exhibition. I feel like you do need some entry points.
Everyone, we're excited to be back with the third season of I Hope This Message Finds You Well, a podcast on curating, where I, Eloise Sweetman, and my friend and colleague Chris Dittle talk to curators about their approach to curating, how they began, and what they love about the profession. In this season of the podcast, we're focusing on the topic of the exhibition.
In this episode, we are in conversation with curator, organizer, and researcher Esther Sakach. We discussed her curatorial beginnings as an assistant, then to making the curatorial dictionary, and her recent exhibition, Dore Mauer, Schumusch, We Are Together, at the Apple Art Center in Amsterdam. For Esther, the exhibition is a space of learning where, according to her, the work begins once the exhibition is open. We also discuss her work with Off Biennial in Budapest and the work that makes exhibitions and events political. We have a thematic focus of this season, and with each of our guests, we want to talk about the exhibition specifically, what it means for us, because it's also a format that, as curators and perhaps artists and other art practitioners or art workers, we take for granted. But in a way, when we talk about it with colleagues, we realize that it means different things to different people or emphasize different aspects of what the exhibition is. So this is something we want to focus on this season. But before we go there, it would be nice to start with a question that we asked also in previous seasons to everyone, that is, what led you to become a curator and how did you come to this profession?
It's mostly by accident, really. It's I was studying art history in Budapest at the ELTE University. And for that... So it was before the Bologna process. It was a 5-year undivided program. And for that, we had to do 120 hours of internship. And yeah, through a different connection, I ended up actually working as the assistant of Hajnal Kasomogyi, who then later became the director of Biennale and the one who initiated it. And she was at that time, she was a freelancer also at that time, and was doing her MA at Bard in curating. And she was doing a group exhibition at the Kunsthalle in Budapest at that time. And she needed a helping hand. And then I said, you know, I have this, you know, 120 hours and I was her assistant. And whew, it was deep waters from the very beginning because, yeah, I never forget the exhibition opened September 26, 2008. And Hoinoko had to travel to New York to already start her course at the end of August. So the last month was all left to me. And I had no idea what the... I mean, she was obviously available through email and stuff, but, you know, she was 6 hours behind. And the Kunsthalle is quite a big one. It was 3/4 of the Kunsthalle. So, yeah, I had to organize shipping and, you know, it was major artist group exhibition, but I did it. And then afterwards, Livia Paldi, who was also working at that time at the Kunsthalle, told me that, well, you did this. Maybe do you want to work here? And but I was still studying. So I was, worked there on a project basis. But so I had to learn quickly what a group exhibition is. So it was quite a rough start. But yeah, and then I got really fascinated about this idea of a curator. And I wanted to know about the history of it. And yeah, so that's, and I kind of stuck with it. I don't know. I mean, I kind of like this idea of that you have to know a lot of things, but you're not an expert in any of them. It's just, it's like you, that you have to work on so many different levels. Yes. And it's just, and it, you know, it's organizing on a very high level. Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I kind of like this.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to kind of like look at all the different projects and activities that you've been doing over the years. And like what comes to my mind immediately is that you're very much research focused and extremely collaborative. And to me, these are two very important things in curating. And I thought maybe could you tell us a little bit about your process and maybe your interest in these two aspects?
Yeah, I completely agree with this. Thank you. Yes, I think really this is this whole research focused thing. It's not because I was trained as an art historian. That doesn't have to do with that. Hopefully, my professors are not listening to it. But so it's again when I really wanted to know something about curating, especially in Hungary, I didn't find anything about it. Yeah. You know, it was an oral history, and it really made me crazy that, you know, everybody said, like, everybody referred to everyone else by their first name. And, you know, like, Joe did this, and then you did that. And I'm like, yeah, but who are these people? And, you know, it became really clear to me within like 2 seconds. And it's just basically one, again, I'm talking about the context of Hungary, especially Budapest, that it's a close-knit circle, but it has a history, but nobody has, you know, talked about it, nobody has written about it. And then I actually decided to do my MA thesis in art history about the history of curating in Hungary after 1989. So that's kind of, me becoming, I don't know, like a curator, first an assistant curator and then a curator. It really was interwoven with this kind of historical, I don't know, outlook to things. And yeah, and I do like to do research. So I think, yeah, for me, maybe that's, I don't know. So I don't know. And especially now that I'm doing my PhD, I think now I feel like what I'm doing as a curator and what I'm doing as a researcher, there are the two things. They are the same things. I'm just working on different sides. So I feel this as a whole. And yeah, and I always think that, yeah, doing something together is a lot more fun than than doing something by myself. So yes, I mean, it's just as simple as that. And I always liked, you know, being part of a community and having different perspectives. And I don't know everything. So it's yeah.
But it's like, it seems that, it's important for you to go deep into something. For example, like the curatorial dictionary being one of them, where that you and the team that you're working with have seen that there are certain words and certain terminology that is being used that is not actually being defined or necessarily defined into the Hungarian language. And each of you, through a group conversation, is trying to actually give these terms a definition, and it requires like time and focus, and it's not just one person, although one person may write the final text. But that's my impression of actually how you work in all your projects, actually.
Yes, yeah, that's also, I would completely agree with it. Yeah, I mean, I do like to go deep. Yeah, staying on the surface actually makes me kind of itchy. but that's true. But yeah, the curatorial dictionary was such an amazing process. I can't remember now how many years we did that, but everything was collaborative, exactly. So we had meetings, I think, every Friday or every other Friday, and we discussed, you know, what we're going to write and who's going to choose which term and what's the angle. And then the person did write it, but the whole process behind it was, yeah, totally collaborative. And yeah, and it was such an interesting moment. It was just, yeah, we started working on it when, yeah, then the government that is still on power just got elected. So yeah, it kind of, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's a different track. But yeah, it was a very, very good time and very good feeling. And yeah, and it was, and I, you know, again, it seemed crazy to us that nobody really talked about how all these English terms are so Anglo-Saxon, and yeah, and maybe there isn't a white cube in other places of the world, but nobody really, you know, thinks about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
It's interesting. Actually, I heard about this curatorial dictionary before we met in Budapest during this infamous meeting from Lara Kaldi, who told me about this. And at the time I was doing research on language and translation, so I was really interested, and I remember looking it up at the time. So we interviewed Lara in the first season of the podcast, and just a side note that I saw, or Eloise pointed out, that Paul O'Neill was also involved as a respondent who we then interviewed the second podcast. So it's like, feels like some kind of circle. But what I actually meant to say is also in response to what Eloise said, that listening to you about your master thesis or also this dictionary project, and then of Barnier, for instance, that is again kind of building up a certain infrastructure that is not only about bringing these people together and kind of forming an infrastructure, but kind of making it also visible and showing that it's relevant, because maybe to an extent, like, these friendships or camaraderie between colleagues is taken for granted. But what happens when you actually kind of draw the lines of this network, and what kind of strength can also emerge from that situation? And that again brings me in a big jump to the question of the exhibition too. In what you just said about, you know, what is a white cube or what is an exhibition in context where this is not a common way of making an exhibition. So one question we would also like to ask with each of our guests is to kind of tell us a little bit about their definition of the exhibition, which perhaps for someone who is like an editor of a dictionary might be quite an apt question to ask.
I didn't really prepare for this question, but I don't know. Then I would say what an exhibition is for me. And yeah, you know, what immediately comes to my mind, just because we worked so much on the dictionary, is, you know, this definition of Maria Lind is, you know, making something public. But I don't know. I think it's a bit more complex than that. For me, I think I would say the exhibition, for me, it's two things, and this is somehow, again, the two tracks I have been kind of working for. If I look at the context of Biennale, so I think the exhibition is, for, in that context, this is something, the image of business as usual, but how it is organized, that's I think that's the political in that. So even though we work with this idea of the exhibition of the biennial, but in it appears as business as usual, but this is also important for us, that, you know, we put all of our efforts into pretending that we can do something as business as usual, but actually it takes a lot of effort to do that. So I think in the format, it's quite conventional. On the one hand, so that's kind of like the grassroots kind of understanding in the context of what I would say about exhibition. But if I look at all the kind of research exhibitions I have done, for me, they have been really a research tool in a way. So every time I did a research exhibition, I've learned so much from it. And, you know, the exhibition opened and that's when the learning process started. So it opened up so many things. And that's why I love giving tours, because this is, you know, taking care also of the exhibition and taking care of all the people who come to this exhibition. So it's not like, you know, I've done an exhibition and, you know, and my job is done. No, that's when the work starts in many ways.
I like that. I like that a lot. No, I feel like it's really nice to hear that, because I feel the same, that I really need to be in the exhibition to really understand what is going on. Like, and I feel often if I don't have that chance, if it's because of, for whatever reason, I feel really disconnected. I feel like I've missed an opportunity to really, particularly from the audience, because it's so exciting to see and hear what an audience has to say in a way that, like, oh, I had no idea that you could look at it like this. And I find that really exciting. What is your favorite part then of curating? Is it being in the exhibition once it's up, or do you have a particular favorite part?
I love the whole process, and I think I especially like to look at the mistakes I have made, because I think that's, you know, like once the exhibition has closed and I have a little bit of a time to think about, you know, all the mistakes I have made. I didn't see it before, but, you know, having gone through all of this experience, I see the mistake, and there are always mistakes we do. And, you know, this kind of takeaways or mistakes is actually the starting point of another project. So this, yeah. So I think, I don't know, I feel like I'm doing just one project in my whole life, and they just, you know, build on each other. And yeah.
That's cool. I like that, because that was going to be my question. Like, do you do something with these mistakes? But yeah, turning them into new exhibitions is a very productive way of addressing them. No, I like that a lot.
I always felt that, especially in like an educational setting, it's much more interesting to, you know, to say that this is what I have learned and these were the mistakes I have made, instead of, you know, just, you know, regurgitating the, I don't know, press release.
What do you think the limitations of the exhibition are? Like, what can't the exhibition do? And second question, what is the potential of the exhibition? What does it do?
I think for the most obvious limitation of an exhibition, I think it's the reach. I mean, so it only speaks to the already converted, so to say. So I found that, yeah, I don't know how to go beyond that, but I, you know, I think it's also fine. I mean, now we live in such a segmented and polarized society, so I don't think there is now a way to talk to the masses. I don't know, we're not in the Cold War anymore. So, yeah, the potential, I don't know, I mean, you know, it's there are many things, you know, so I also do other projects than just the exhibition, but maybe from my perspective, I think it's a super interesting interface, and again, an interface with people who are, again, or they already converted. But yeah, I think for me, an exhibition is a discussion mostly. So it's not like, again, I really like to engage with the exhibition and not, so again, that the work, as I mentioned earlier, that the work begins when the exhibition opens. And yeah, and it was also a very hard lesson. For instance, that Documenta 15, this is also the the work started when the exhibition opened, so to say. But yeah, so I think, I don't know, I think the only word I can think of is this interface. And I think there are so many things you can do in an exhibition, and what you call an exhibition, and you know, and it was such a really amazing, you know, thing to be part of the Lumbung and work in the Lumbung, for instance, at Documenta 15, where there were so many different ideas of what an exhibition is. So for me, that was a super inspiring to just walk through, you know, all the different venues and to see all these different ideas, which is not this kind of super white cube. And yeah, and also I think for what is for me, and I know many people don't agree with this, but for me, what the limitation is of an exhibition, it's when an exhibition tries to narrate, or I don't know, like engage with the topic on a thematic level. So all the artworks speak about a problem, but I don't know. For me, again, you know, I'm coming from this, you know, more of a grassroots level. For me, always the politics is in the organizational. So how an exhibition is done, this is what is important to me, not necessarily what is presented. And, you know, and I feel like, I don't know, those exhibitions to me are maybe like two dimensionals or one dimensional. I don't know when the thematics are, it's only embedded in the artwork. So you watch a film or you, I don't know, you look at an art object and you are supposed to, you know, get the theme.
I think we both agree with you.
We're heavily nodding.
Yeah. I think we both take that approach. And I think that's also why, from my position, why I like to think that an exhibition isn't ever finished. I like, and what I like about what you were saying about realizing your mistakes and trying to address them and using what you've learnt in new exhibitions, because like the work is not necessarily ever done. Yeah, and that, and also like one's method of working should correspond with what's going on in the exhibition. And I really agree with you.
Yeah, I already had the impression from what I know about your work or when I read some interviews that for you the exhibition cannot be, for us I think also, disconnected from the infrastructural and the political in that sense. But it also made me think, on the other hand, what I said earlier about I read your practice in a way as kind of drafting these lines and connections. And again, there is this emphasis of making these connections or communities, both towards the public, perhaps through these, like what you say, these, you do many tours and start the exhibition once it opens, that's when the work starts, but also the infrastructure building that is always happening kind of in the background, which is not the public part. But that's why oftentimes I feel like in our field it is also so much mystified, because perhaps not everyone is so engaged with that sort of infrastructure building. Mm. But I lost a little bit my chain of thought. There was a conclusion to this. All right. There was an interview where you talked about, or a text perhaps that you wrote in relation to Off Biennial, that it's been criticized for being very much, you know, just talking to indeed those who've been already converted or engaging only with the artists who were already there. But you also responded to it that this critique of serving only its own community is also irrelevant, in a sense that it does create a sense of belonging and community between these people who otherwise are like these separated actors. Mm-hmm. And perhaps the same thing is happening also towards audiences then, that I think from my experience when I do guided tours or public programs, I think that's also when you can make this connection somehow visible or palpable between what is presented in the exhibition and who comes to visit. This was a little long monologue, but yeah. I got somewhere.
Yeah, I can agree with myself.
I wanted to have this on record. You know, I wanted to quote you on record.
I think it's fine, though. Yeah, because I don't know. I mean, we organized an event for our own community, and what's wrong about this? So I mean, yeah, it's for ourselves, but you know, if we don't do it, then there's not even this. So it's really, so I think the power also lies within that, you know, there's something to look forward to. And you know, there are not many things, I mean, of course there are things happening in Budapest, but you know, there are so many places which are closed, so many people are left, I also left, half of my body is still in Budapest, and I'm still involved in OFF, but, I also halfly not there. And I think it's very important that it's a different type of taking care of the community. The exhibition at the OPPO, which is with works by, but also by this Hungarian artist, Dóra Maurer, now I really embedded it in a Dutch context. So I think that's kind of like a trajectory in a way.
Is this embeddedness coming from the kind of reference to this exhibition that took place in the 70s at the OPPO with this Hungarian artist, or is there like kind of a larger or different way of contextualizing it in this context?
Yeah, so that's one thing, that there was this exhibition Works and Words at the OPPO in 1979, and she was a participating artist there, but also because it's about a collective or an informal group that Dora, which was mostly led by Dora and her husband, and they refer to themselves as Sumus. So they were actually facilitating a lot of exhibitions during the Cold War in the West, and also they did quite a few things in the Netherlands as well. So, yeah, I included in the exhibition a few exhibitions that they were contributing to in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam.
To me, it's also fascinating because, in the Dutch context, I feel there is always such a great emphasis on visitor numbers and who comes to your exhibition and who are your visitors, who are you targeting, in the kind of filthiest marketing sense with your exhibition. And to an extent, I find these questions very relevant. And, it's been drilled into me also through my curatorial training somehow and experience to think about like how to also accommodate different needs and know like actually what context you are embedded in. On the other hand, oftentimes this question doesn't necessarily come from this perspective of accessibility, but rather, visitor numbers, or is our tax money spent justly, or is it justified that this 20,000 euros is spent on something, which to an extent I understand, but, I think here somehow the exhibition as an interface starts to work against us, because in a way it is relatively cheap infrastructure if you compare it to anything else, but it's incredibly efficient in terms of visibility and communication and so on. So on one hand, it can work very well if you want to communicate or do things in an efficient way, but I mean in a larger infrastructural sense, but it can also backfire because we can be caught on these, especially when it comes to budget cuts in the Netherlands, it's always like, oh, this is like an excess, look at all this money, yeah, and nobody goes there, etc., etc. Yeah. And yet I find this aspect of community building, and even if it's a community of these practitioners, quite powerful in that sense.
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know, for instance, how many people have seen the exhibition at the OPPO yet. I will ask. I don't know yet. But what is important to me, exactly what you were saying, Chris, is if somebody comes, and I even sent around an email to colleagues and friends, if you want to come to the exhibition, let me know. I'm happy to walk with you. And I think last week or a week before, my fellow PhD students came, and then I took a walk with them to the exhibition. It was such a nice experience. And, I'm much more interested in this type of situations, or building connections. Or, for instance, Dora couldn't come to the opening, and, she's 86. And, of course, it was an exhibition also very much without her presence. But I came up with this idea of doing a group photo that I asked all the people at the opening to come for a group photo, not for social media and not to post to anywhere, but it's really just for Dora to send this group photo that, these people were there. And then we even made a little sign that says her name and the exhibition and the OPPO and yeah. And then, and I sent it to her. And then she emailed back that, it's such a joy to look at so many nice people. And when you see them, please tell everyone that I send my friendly hello and I say thank you. And, this was, you know, it really touched my heart. And, you know, and I said, yeah, this is what the exhibition is about.
Yeah, that's cool. I like that. Actually, that's a really nice thing to do. I'm going to take that idea, if you don't mind. Because I think that that is also like a really important, to, you know, every exhibition has an artist, and if they cannot, you know, be there to also make sure that they are included in such a, you know, beautiful way, actually. I mean, I could imagine getting that photo and feeling very proud. Yeah, what a great idea. Now, I think for me, the exhibition is very important. I think like, and the relationship that the curator has with an artist is also, I think we all agree that relationship's very important. And I think also in the case where you're presenting an older artist and going into an archive, a living older artist and going into an archive is very important, I think, also for a new generation, you know. And yeah, okay, they may be the already converted, but actually not necessarily, like, you know, it's a whole brand new group of people that will come to know an important artist who's very exciting, I think. Do you relate to her practice? Like, in some ways, I kind of see a very strong connection between you as a curator and her as an artist, and that you both have similar goals in your work.
Yeah, it's really, it's, you know, I mean, it's how this exhibition came about is through my PhD. So, you know, my main case study in my PhD at the University of Amsterdam, and I'm probably part of this group called Imagine Art, it's of Biennale. And, you know, that's my main case study, but what I'm really looking at is how artists and culture workers organized from the bottom up against the state. And, you know, in an Eastern European context, the main enemy is always the state. So it was the state today, and it was before too. And I was looking at, my question was basically, who are our mothers and fathers? So who was doing the same thing in state socialism, which is of course a very different context from today, but, you know, there was repression too. So the kind of the repression, the levels were of course different, but there was repression. So I was really interested in strategies. So again, not necessarily what people were doing, but what were the strategies that they used. And there were some candidates who could be case studies for my mothers and fathers. But then I came across Dora Maura's organizing practice. I knew about it before, and that, you know, she did this and that. But then I came a republication of her text that she herself wrote in 2002 about this thing called Sumus, which is then I made the theme or the main subject of the exhibition, that they organize these amazing things invisibly, basically. So they really built an invisible art infrastructure. So very shortly, what Dora and her husband mostly did as part of this group called Sumus, that because of their personal lives, they had this double residency between Budapest and Vienna. Again, the context of the Cold War, and so which enabled them to travel between or across the Iron Curtain quite easily. And they used this, it was a power position, but they used this power position to distribute. So basically facilitate all the artists who did not have much chance to exhibit in Hungary, because they were the progressive, abstract, conceptual, geometric artists, which were not supported by the state at that time. So they said, okay, so let's bring these artists to the West when there's, so to say, market or there's attention for these types of artistic practices. And so basically, they became background organizers for many group exhibitions in the 70s and 80s in the so-called West, but they also transported many of the artworks. So they had a little Volkswagen minibus, and they transported the works too. And in the exhibition catalogs, they're not credited, and because they were not actually the curators, but they were the ones who said that, you know, you should include this artist and this artist and this artist and this artist, but they were not credited also because this, you know, had to be done in secret because this was an unofficial kind of presentation. So it was also for the protection of themselves and all the other artists who they also brought. And what I admire about Dora is that she did it totally separate from her artistic practice. You know, and she did this very quietly, very invisibly. And she's such a well-known artist, and so many things have been written about her. You know, she had the solo show at Tate Modern in 2019. And so, yeah, but I'm like, come on, people, what have you done before? Like, really? I mean, she has, you know, she has been producing work since the 1950s. So obviously there are many things to be written about her. But yeah, so to me, this was the most exciting. And I really love this idea that, you know, she didn't care. She said, OK, if this is not loud, I find a way. I'll do it. I don't care. This kind of attitude that I'm going to do it no matter what. And I'm going to find a way, and, you know, and I don't have to take credit for it. What is really needed is that things happen and these artists get shown and people get to know them. And yeah, then my job is done.
That's cool. Funny, I saw that exhibition at the Tate in 2019, and I was very excited to get to know Dora's work. But actually, when looking into your exhibition, which I am still going to see, I didn't click to me that it was the same artist, actually. It was, I mean, I recognized the name, but what you're saying is so true. Like, there really is quite a separation between what she's known for and actually this kind of hidden, unknown part. And I find that also really exciting, that also an entire other life can be lived by an artist. And also, I feel like this is a really good example of what the exhibition can do, actually, through the networks of the artists themselves, you know, like to have their works transported in secret, and then that an exhibition is actually super radical and very urgent.
So in that sense, it actually connects the kind of, say, the display and presentational mode of the exhibition and the infrastructural that we spoke about earlier, that
true.
You can show both.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, totally.
Although it's maybe from a historical perspective, I wonder what would happen to it now, you know, like now you show your network and maybe you do. I don't know.
Ah, we don't know. Maybe Esther has a whole other life that she's living that we don't know about until for another 50 years, you know? Yeah, that's kind of exciting.
But just in terms of, you know, the question of the exhibition, like how does one show then this invisible aspect when, you know, there are only a few tangibles, and which is, again, an oral history. So, yeah, I had a lot of time thinking about how can I present this amazing story, which is a story, you know, in an exhibition. And the only way I found that I could go about it, and I'm really curious, you know, what I will learn about this after the exhibition has closed. But so basically, there are two main ways to engage with this exhibition, because there are also seven films that I selected from Dora's film Over, which is, yeah, she only did films between the 60s and the 80s. And also some of her films she labeled as Sumus, again, just to signify this collaborative, do-it-yourself, self-financed aspect, you know, this grassroots aspect of her work. So you can just engage with the films. I mean, they're very, you know, structural, conceptual. There's only one that has narrative, but that's, you know, that Dora Maurer's filmic practice. That's also fine. But there's also this kind of archival material section. And there are some archival material, letter correspondences, but also some books and publications and catalogs and digital copies. And I actually recorded an audio piece, which I called it an audio guide, 20 minutes long. And it's really, and I titled this is a story of Sumus. So basically I narrate in that 20-minute piece I narrate all the books, and so basically sweeps together the archival materials, and this is the context of all of this. But you don't have to listen to it if you don't want to. It's really like, you know, taking this researcher's position and getting to know all the context. But, you know, if you listen to it 20 minutes, you know the whole story. You know what you're looking at. You don't have to read anything. You just listen to it. But if you don't want to engage with that, you just see the films.
Nice.
Thank you for listening, and we will be back with another episode in 2 weeks. If you have feedback, we'd love to receive your email at ihopethismessagefindsyouwell@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Instagram at ihopethismessage and find us on SoundCloud under the same handle.
The jingle was made by artist Natalia Sozano, sound engineering was done by Nick Thomas, and our graphic designer is Christoph Klarais. And by the way, we've launched our first I Hope This Message Finds You Well t-shirt based on Christoph Klarais's design. And you can purchase our t-shirts via Everpress, linked in the show notes below.
I hope this message finds you well. I hope this message finds you well. I hope this message finds you well. I hope this message finds you.